Blog Talk Radio.
Winners, losers, and the Tea Party. We're going to talk this hour about the midterm elections, what happened on Tuesday, November 2nd, where we stand now, what is yet unresolved here in the United States. Surely, going forward, it's going to be a very, very interesting year, and certainly leading up to the 2012 elections, who knows what's going to happen and who's going to run. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas, and you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. Good afternoon, everyone. We're back to our normal time here on Thursday, and we're really glad that you're listening either live or certainly as a download. We're going to basically ask you to take your pencils and pens out again. This is going to be more of a teachable session, a teachable program today, talking about the midterm elections that took place 2 days ago, November 2nd. During the second half of the hour, syndicated columnist and good friend and colleague George Curry is going to join us to give his assessment live from Washington, D.C. We're going to talk about the midterm elections. I think it's like no other. Certainly the 2006 midterm election was a setup for the 2008 presidential election. And who's to say that these elections that took place 2 days ago will not be a forerunner for what will happen in the year 2012 when we reelect the congressional representation, reelect more senators or elect new senators, along with state and local elections, and most importantly, have another presidential election. I don't know where to start, but I think what I want to do today is to first sort of paint the landscape of what happened on Tuesday, give you some facts and some figures. I have some cards that I've pulled out from a sex called the American Civics and Politics. These are flash cards, knowledge cards that have information that has been well researched, and then most specifically give you some information about what took place here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I would say that despite all the ups and downs, the setbacks, the people who were defeated in elections, the elections that are being contested or haven't been called yet, there were some amazing things that took place here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that really defied the election of Scott Brown several months ago. I'm sure that those who are leaning Republican or who are conservative or those who wanted to see changes take place in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts were sadly disappointed just based on the election results. So a little bit later on, I'll talk to you about that. So we want to cover national. We want to cover some of the state elections and definitely local elections because I am really a believer now that all things, all politics is local. That's the saying that Tip O'Neill created several years ago before he passed away. But truly, when you are looking at some of the movements that are happening across the United States, particularly with the Tea Party, you are looking at local activities, local elections, local issues that then become the center point of someone getting involved, raising money, and then taking the stakes to a higher level. So the local impetus is as important as what's going on the national level. So we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But most of all, I don't have the stats in front of me, and I'm sure that in the coming weeks we'll get more clarification of what happened. But across the board, the numbers of people who went out to vote were quite high, higher than had been projected, and in some case there were some records that were tied based on the locale that you're from. But typically, and certainly because of many factors, because there were some hotly contested races, there were definitely ballot questions that were on the books for many people, certainly here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And other factors, certainly technology, led to more people going out to the polls and getting involved in the election process here in the United States. I am a self-confessed election junkie. I vote every single time with very few exceptions. I will rearrange trips so that I will vote, and my children vote, my adult daughters vote. In fact, my adult daughter here in the area where I live in the Boston area, and I voted at the same time. And then my other daughter, who lives in Connecticut with her husband and baby, they voted in Connecticut. And that's another race that is now has not been called the gubernatorial race in Connecticut. So we are from a family of people who vote. We're African American, so voting is extremely important to us. It baffles me. It really baffles me in this day and time, with so much on the line, with an economy that we're struggling with jobs that need to be created, why people don't vote. Who you vote for is up to you. My show is not about persuading one person to vote for one particular candidate. That really is up to you. But the importance of voting can't be emphasized. It can't be emphasized enough. Literally our industries, our corporations, our policies, our procedures, laws that affect us, so much of what we do is based on the impact of voting. And for those who don't vote, I'm just always at a loss to figure out why that doesn't happen. In fact, I'm going to try to pull out some information that will give you a little sense of why voting is so important. So voting is important, and we had a higher level of people who voted during this election, and that's really, really good. Who they voted for was across the board. It differed from place to place, and we had some upsets. We had some circumstances that were quite interesting. And again, we have some contested races right now, or races that have not been called. And in the case of Washington State, with that senatorial race that is still too close to be called, and the voting in Washington State is all done by mail, it may be quite some time before that particular race is called. In the state of Alaska, with Lisa Murkowski, who taught people how to spell her name, she is right now ahead in the vote tally against Joe Miller, who she was defeated by as a Republican during the Republican primary, and then she decided to run as a write-in candidate in the state of Alaska, and right now, interestingly so, she is ahead with about 41% of the vote. Now, again, we won't know what will happen with that particular race for several weeks, because all those votes have to be counted and then certified and the like. So it's just very interesting and amazing what is taking place with voting and with who is voting across the country. Let me read this to you, because, again, I told you I am a voting fanatic, and I just believe in voting. I think people who don't vote, unless they're deathly ill or they just can't make it out and they couldn't get that absentee ballot, to forget to vote, I cringe. I just really, really cringe, because so much can happen based on one vote. I think next week or the following week, once I verify all the information, I have another piece that I'll share with you about buy one vote that I actually shared with my email audience and sent it out, and I want to make a couple of corrections and adjustments, and then I'll send that back out, and then I'll probably read that on the air. But this is something that says why people should get involved in voting and why politics are so important. It says politics and politicians decide the wars you fight, the interest you pay, the speed you drive, the taxes you pay. Politics and politicians control the purity of your food, the schooling of your children, the value of your money, the weights and measures you use, the floors under your wages. Politics and politicians hand out subsidies to farmers, subsidies to airlines, subsidies to oil companies, subsidies to magazines and newspapers, subsidies to bankers, subsidies to builders. Politics and politicians protect or destroy your right to speak freely, your right to worship freely, your right to organize, your right to vote. Politics and politicians control your life. And when you look at it from that perspective and that way, it lets you know that it is really your responsibility to take control of your vote and let your voice be known. When you don't vote, then you literally abdicate the control and power that you have, and you give that to someone else. This is not talking about those who have lost the right to vote because of felony convictions, etc. That's another conversation. But those who actually have the right to vote, it is really in their best interest. They really are making decisions and helping to really foster the democratic process here in the United States by voting. So I'm a voting fanatic, and I would argue anybody down who doesn't vote, it really is that important. So we had this interesting election that took place this Tuesday, with some winners, some losers, some people who aren't coming back to office, some people who surprisingly are coming back to office, a balance of power that has shifted. I won't give the numbers because, again, we've got all these elections that still haven't been finalized yet, and the numbers may slightly change, but we do know that in the House of Representatives, the power has shifted from the Democrats to the Republicans. The Republicans now have more than 50% of the 435 elected congressmen, and Nancy Pelosi is no longer the Speaker of the House. And I want to read to you a little bit about the Speaker of the House in one of these cards that I have. That power is now, as of January 20th, or January 1st, that is going to shift to John Boehner from Ohio, who is a 20-year veteran Republican. And he will become the new Speaker of the House. Now, let me just share some information with you about the Speaker of the House. That's why this is going to be a teachable session along with more information. The Speaker of the House is the presiding officer of the House of Representatives, the most powerful position in the legislative branch and second in line behind the Vice President to the presidency. The Speaker is chosen by members of the House, though he or she is not required to be a member of the House or of the majority party. I didn't realize that. Speakers have the sole power to recognize members and rules and rule on points of parliamentary procedure. They control the flow of legislation by scheduling votes on bills or removing bills from the calendar. They have a great influence on the work of committees by making both appointments and by choosing what bills are referred to committees. They select the chairman of the House of Committee of the Whole, as well as all the majority members of the Rules Committee, key positions for speeding up floor actions and choosing bills to be considered for a vote. Speakers serve for as long as their party is in the majority. And so that's why we have a shift now coming up between Nancy Pelosi, Democrat, who will be leaving as Speaker of the House. She is still a congresswoman. She just got reelected. It remains to be seen what's going to happen with her after January. She's made no announcements about retiring or anything else. Excuse me. But that will be shifted from her to John Boehner. And as of the 20th century, these cards are a little dated. It said they've seen only 15 speakers. There are more speakers since these cards have actually been printed. Why is this all important? Why am I sharing this with you? Because sometime between now and 2012, and obviously this year it took place, we had a census. And with that census will come adjusted, updated numbers in terms of how many people are living in the United States, and how many people are living in states, and how many people are living in counties. All of that affects our number of congresspersons that we send to the House of Representatives. The Senate never changes. We will always have two senators from each state, regardless of what state you live in, large or small. But the House of Representatives changes, the number of congressional representatives change based on population. So since we have the census, they're going to update the numbers and figure out which state will lose congressional representation and which states will add on to it sometime between now and I believe it's 2012. That's why the Speaker of the House is going to have an extremely powerful position in Congress, because he, John Boehner, will work with the Republican leadership And they will largely, along with the Census Bureau and all of the other powers to be, will oversee the redistricting that will take place in every state in the country. In the state of Massachusetts, we are scheduled to possibly lose a Senate seat, lose a congressional seat, because our numbers have fallen in the last 10 years. That will be the same case in every state based on how many people they have increased in numbers in the last 10 years and how many they have lost. That will all be used in determining how many congressional delegates or how many congresspersons will be allotted for every single state. So this year, next year, and the following year are going to be very, very important. And among other things, and including the health care bill that everybody is really talking about, but including that, there will be many important decisions made that John Boehner and the Republican Party in the House of Representatives will have direct access to and they will be responsible for. So that's just a little heads up on that. And again, it just goes back to voting, who votes, who doesn't vote, who gets in power, et cetera. Because so many of the races across the country were close, were very, very close. And again, we've got, you know, we don't have a declared victor in Washington. We don't have a declared Senate gubernatorial winner in the state of Connecticut, as I had gone on the air. We thought that the Republican candidate, Malloy, had won, but that's not necessarily the official announcement at this point, because there were contested ballots and a confusion about ballots in Bridgeport, Connecticut. They ran out of ballots. They wanted to use copied or photographed ballots, and then they brought in some ballots. They extended the hours to vote. They didn't stop voting until 10 o'clock at night. And then all those ballots have to be certified, so therefore we don't have a declared gubernatorial candidate in the state of Connecticut. So, again, there are things that are going to have to be worked out and decisions that will have to be made in terms of who got elected in some of these cases. But across the board, there were some interesting surprises. There were many, many Democratic losses. There were quite a few. I now have been told and looked at some of the stats that in the Democratic Party, amongst the blue dog Democrats, over half of them lost their races primarily because of the health care bill. If, in fact, regardless of whether they supported or didn't support the health care bill, the populations across the country are angry and very reactionary and definitely took it out on those incumbent, those the politicians who were already in office. And that was the law of the land across the country. There were some very big wins, though. In the state of New York, in the gubernatorial race, Mario Cuomo did win, and he won over his Republican opponent, who I thought was a very strange man, along with some of the other opponents that were running as third-party candidates. In the state of California, very interesting, Barbara Boxer won her Senate seat back against Carly Fioroni, who was the former head of Hewlett-Packard. That was a very interesting, kind of a tight race, but Barbara Boxer pulled it off. And in the gubernatorial race in California, Jerry Brown is back again, and I have a sheet here that talks about that. Jerry Brown left office 28 years ago, and now he is back in office as governor over Meg Whitman, who got involved in a big mess. She was saying one thing, but, oh, she sort of forgot that her housekeeper was an undocumented worker, and that tripped her up, and I think amongst other things, she lost. What was interesting about that particular race was the amount of money that was spent. I believe Meg Whitman spent about $175 million of her own money for the race to become governor, and she lost. We have a lot of thinking to do in this country, a lot of introspection that needs to take place in terms of how much is too much, particularly when you don't even scrub your own house and when you are caught in a lie. You don't really know how to respond. So regardless of how much money Meg Whitman had or did not have, The people of California said, no, we want someone who is tried and tested. He may have his own issues, but at least we know where he's coming from. And in that case, they said no to Meg Whitman. What I think is really interesting is across the country, just the number of people who are swept up and caught up in the Tea Party movement. It is really not, it's a movement more than a party. A party, and I have a third-party piece here that I'll read to you right now. It's not really a movement, but it is a party, but it's a collection of people in various parts of the country who are operating largely on the local level, who are angry and upset with how things are taking place here in the United States. And this is what I have. This is, again, from this deck of American civics and politics that I'll read about third parties. Because the electoral process has evolved around a two-party system, third parties are formed as an ad hoc protest for a specific election, which we're now seeing. Usually a splinter group formed by a disgruntled former candidate or one of the two major parties, a third party is one whose presidential candidate received between 5 and 25% of the popular vote, making the party eligible for federal campaign funds in the next election. Third parties are temporary gadflies arising during times of voter disgust or when there is no discernible difference between the two major parties. We're living in these times right now with the Tea Party. The most successful third-party presidential candidate in history was Theodore Roosevelt in 1912. After winning the Republican primary, Roosevelt was passed over at the nomination convention. He then formed the Bull Moose Party. He won 27.4% of the vote, but split the Republicans, allowing Woodrow Wilson, Democrat, to win. That's what happens with third-party candidates. We saw it here to a degree in Massachusetts with Tim Cahill, who ran as an independent. The second highest vote total of the third-party candidate was the Know-Nothing Party nominee, Millard Fillmore, in 1856. He won 21.5% of the vote. And the third one we saw in 1992 with Ross Perot, he won 18.9% of the vote. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I would dare say that at some point there is going to be a Tea Party. There's going to be a formal Tea Party from this Tea Party movement that is taking place in the United States. Now, the Tea Party failed to get Christine O'Donnell elected in Delaware. She was a very interesting and very strange candidate, but she did not win. And the gentleman who did win in Delaware was a long shot at the beginning of the election. And because she won, that sort of shifted things his way, and he actually came out victorious. Now, what I thought was quite interesting as well took place in Nevada. Now, we've talked about the House of Representatives, and there was a little bit of concern about the Senate then also changing hands and the Republicans controlling the Senate. That does not look like it's going to happen. It's going to stay in the hands of the Democrats. And Harry Reid, who was running a very, very tough race against Sharon Angle, did pull it out, and he won fairly handily in the state of Nevada. What was interesting about his race, along with other races across the country, was the minority vote, the votes by blacks and Hispanics and people of color, who then swung their support toward Democratic candidates, and certainly Harry Reid is in that category. And he won in part, in a very important part, because of the minority vote. There were some comments that were made by Sharon Angle. Again, I just think the woman is strange. I'm sorry. I think she's strange. She's a Tea Party member. I don't understand the Tea Party, per se, as a person of color. I don't understand people of color who were in the Tea Party. I really don't understand them. But Sharon Angle made comments about Hispanics looking Asian, and she thought they looked Asian. She made some other very offhanded comments that offended people, and her leadership style and some of the other comments that she made ultimately helped out Harry Reid, who had his own issues in the state of Nevada, but he prevailed anyway. In the state of Massachusetts, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we had some very interesting things that took place here as well. Again, Tuesday was a remarkable day. I was busy that day, but stayed up half the night like so many other people, just trying to figure out what was going on. So, and I have a very busy chat room, and that's great. I'm going to read some of these comments too. The one thing is in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we have largely been Democratic for many, many years. We are thought of as a very liberal state, and it sort of proved itself out on Tuesday. Scott Brown, back in January with a special election, won the seat that had been held by Ted Kennedy for many years, and people were absolutely amazed and shocked because he, A, was a Republican, and B, he was very heavily supported by the Tea Party. Now, I've met with Scott Brown. He's a nice person. I asked him some tough questions. I wanted to know how he was going to support the entire state, the whole Commonwealth, knowing that there were people of color who were here and the like. Nonetheless, he did win the election, and the expectation was that Scott Brown was going to then deliver Massachusetts as a red state, as a state that would really represent the Republican Party in strong numbers. It didn't happen. It did not happen. First of all, our governor was reelected. Deval Patrick, who I supported and who I voted for very heavily, he was the winner, won against Charlie Baker, who is was the Republican nominee, spent a ton of money. We had Tim Cahill, who was our former, he's still our treasurer, but will be leaving that position. He is also an independent, no longer a Democrat. He ran as a third-party person. He actually helped split the Charlie Baker vote. Charlie Baker ran a very negative campaign, as his predecessor did 4 years ago, Kerry Healy. And both of them ran very negative campaigns, and it worked against them. I think ultimately the state said, no, we know that our governor has made mistakes early on in his leadership, but he is doing whatever he can to bring people together and to make a difference for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And he won. He won handily. The thing I liked about Deval Patrick and what he said that we need to turn to each other during these times of economic uncertainty, not on each other. Charlie Baker ran a very negative campaign. Deval Patrick ran, again, for the second time, a very positive campaign. And I think that positive nature won him out. Barney Frank is my representative. He is my congressman. And I think a great deal of him. He's a results-oriented person. And he also won against his opponent. And the one thing he said I thought that was quite interesting, he said the collective campaigns, this is Barney Frank, that were run by most Republicans were beneath the dignity of democracy. There were just a lot of very negative campaigns out there, an awful lot. So it's been an interesting ride. And here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, every one of the congressional delegates, all nine, were reelected. They're all Democrats. Our state auditor's race was quite hot and contested, and the Democrat won out there, Suzanne Bump. And then the 10th district, which was an open seat, was also won by a Democrat. So here you have a very blue state, a very, very blue state. And I'm just going to read some of the comments. I'm looking, and we have a very hot chat room that's going on, and one of the callers has said, personally, I would never believe a story about her spending $175 million. We're talking about Meg Whitman in California again. And other comments are here, very hotly contested, very interesting comments, and I appreciate them because we need to really talk more and dialogue more. So as we bring on our guest, I want the chat room to continue to be live and very active. I want to bring our guest on now. He is a syndicated columnist and nationally recognized journalist, been in the business an awfully long time. He sort of set the stage for what happened across the country here in Massachusetts. And now I want to hear from my very good friend in Washington, D.C., George Curry. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I tell you, we have an awful lot to talk about, and I have a lot of people in the chat room who are just going at it. So can you please explain to us what happened on Tuesday?
Well, I think in the simplest term, people are frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
People are disappointed at the unemployment rate. Don't really see a clear end to all this. And when you have a Democrat controlling the House, the Senate, and the White House, shouldn't be surprising that people's anger gets focused on them. And this mm-hmm. is traditionally what happens in an off-year election anyway, or you mm-hmm. lose seat, but nobody predicted it would be that many in the House. And
yeah.
But, you know, we go back and forth. It wouldn't matter if it had been Republican in office and had the unemployment rate been where it is now, they would have suffered the same fate. So that's kind of our democracy. That's kind of the way we function.
You know, and again, I tried to set the stage before you came on the air just to give people background and information, particularly about the Speaker of the House and the importance of John Boehner's role that he's going to play as it relates to redistricting and what's going to happen with how the representation will take place across the board. The Republicans are going to control that. And but also I looked at some of the stats that went back all the way to, I have numbers back to 1945. There's been this seesaw of power for many,
yeah.
many years. And
it's
not going to change.
That's pretty much the standard. But what we've got to understand, too, is a lot of this is about politics. I mean, really it has nothing to do with what's best for America.
Mm-hmm.
We need to say that. Because the Republicans calculated very correctly that if they just – to oppose everything that Obama stood for, that they will have wins during this mid-year election cycle, and that has worked out. Now, mm-hmm. the hard politics of this is that they are already focusing on 2 years from now, because
right.
at that time, Democrats will have to defend 23 seats, and
mm-hmm.
they'll have to defend only 10.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are looking, saying this is the first step in a two-step process where they will take the Senate and the White House in 2012. That's what this is all about. And you can see the lines being drawn now. Instead of
yeah.
saying, okay, the American public said they want us to work together, no, that's not the sentiment. You hear Obama saying basically, you know, we need to find a way to compromise.
Mm-hmm.
But Republicans are emboldened. I mean, in fact, I think the one thing that Boehner said, he said health care bill is has ruined our health care system and bankrupt our country. So that's the first thing he wants to start. That's a non-starter. And then you got McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, saying,
right.
you know, there's two opportunities for change to occur. They can come to our side, or we can change in 2012. That's where it is. So I don't think either party got the message. They're just
mm-hmm.
sick of the gridlock, because when you look at the exit polls, you see people are disgusted with both the Democrats and the Republicans.
The disgust is there. The concern that I have, George, and
mm-hmm.
The concern I have is the plan with the Republicans by and large not really having a specific plan to A, create jobs, because everybody's talking about we don't have jobs here,
right?
And B, tied in with that, to improve and change the economy, and ultimately to reduce our deficits that we have. Are you seeing now? Let me also step back and say Charlie Baker here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
he did have a plan,
mm-hmm.
and in fact, Deval Patrick has said that some of the ideas that Charlie had are very good ones, and he will entertain them. So
mm-hmm.
that's I think the one consideration I would say in terms of a Republican who did have a plan. But across the board, I'm hearing a lot of rhetoric. I'm hearing a whole lot of talking points that are just repeated all the time with freedom and take my country back. What does that
right.
mean? And how does that relate to a specific plan of action that is going to move this country forward?
Well, if you look at their blueprint, which is Pledge to America, you see that it's not they're not much, much not much they're different than what you've seen under the old George Bush plan. I mean, you really don't. And also,
mm-hmm.
I think this deficit thing is a serious issue. But when you look at things that people really care about, it doesn't rank that high. I mean, people
mm-hmm.
want jobs, jobs, jobs.
Yeah.
And everybody has to get that message. Now, the problem is that the federal government can help some, but they are not really my primary engine for job creation. That's basically
right.
small business. And so you have this time of unease And you have, you know, when the federal government does do something to stabilize the financial market and all the industry, they get criticized for it. And mm-hmm. and so it's going to be a trying time. I don't yep. think it's a difference between running against somebody and saying we want to get the power, and quite different when you say, okay, now you're there, we got to govern.
And that's the key statement that you've made. Absolutely, what's going to happen between, you know, now that well, certainly after January 1st, when all of the newly elected senators and congresspersons are in place, and certainly on the local level too. You know, what are they going to do to govern? George, yeah. what are you seeing with the Tea Party? And I'll start off by saying I live in a town where the Tea Party is pretty active,
mm-hmm.
and I'm trying to figure them out. I went to a town meeting about 3 weeks ago, and it was absolutely amazing to see the Tea Party in action. We had mm-hmm. a big company that wanted to come in town. It was going to create jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, the opposition went to work. They worked for weeks and ultimately defeated the measure and defeated
mm-hmm.
another measure, too. And I saw the town I live in. It was split, literally split down the middle. So what are you – so I'm seeing it on the local level. What are you seeing from D.C. All the way to California or Hawaii? What are you seeing in terms of movement and activity with the Tea Party?
Well, people talk about the Tea Party as though it's one party. It's not. It's really a collective of different fractured groups. So it's not just a they don't have other than disappointment and disgust with the federal government. They really don't have much going in terms of unity. Now, they have been able, like most people are, to tap into the anger of the electorate, mm-hmm. frustrated people, and they've seen that. Now, I think their biggest headache is going to be to the Republican Party. I mean, mm-hmm. what we've seen already is you had even some slightly moderate. You don't have a whole lot of moderate Republicans like you used to have, but even some who could have won, say, like in Delaware. And they have chased them out of the party, and so they end up being nominee. And so in a lot of cases they lost, but some they won. And now the Republican Party doesn't know what to do with them because basically they're not saying we're Republican. They're saying, although most of them are affiliated and voted for Republicans, they're basically saying, you know, we don't like either party. So
mm-hmm.
it's going to be some interesting dynamic when they come to even to the Senate and how they're going to deal with them because they are an X factor. They don't know exactly how they're going to respond to them. A lot of them do express extreme views. Even libertarians like Rand Paul, I mean, just, you know, even to the right of his father. And so, mm-hmm. again, one thing to campaign, another thing to try to govern, and Republic, mm-hmm. I think it's going to be the biggest headache for the Republican Party, more so than Democrats.
You know, I predicted 2 years ago in 2008, just based on the election of Obama, I said, and what I was seeing with the Republican Party at that point in time, I said that I felt that there would be a third party shortly that would come out of the Republican Party just based on the rhetoric I was hearing, the comments that were being made, not even knowing that this Tea Party would be so active.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of years before that, around 06 or so, I interviewed Victor Gold, who wrote a book called The Invasion of the Party Crashers. He's a longtime Barry Goldwater Republican who also saw the disintegration of his party before his very eyes and wrote a book about it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with that said, do you think that the Tea Party will ultimately become the third party? Do you think they will continue to wreak havoc with the Republican Party? What do you think is going to happen with them?
Well, again, like I said, it's a collection of organizations. So I think mm-hmm. you see their influence at local level on whoever is being elected at that level. And so in terms of national, I don't think they're a national force. I mean, it's just
mm-hmm.
these different collectives there. So they will have like the impact they had like in Nevada and certainly Colorado and Delaware. So they will pick the local candidates and they will give them fits in terms of who will be the Republican nominee. And
mm-hmm.
so you don't see a movement like you see with Ross Perot to go out and get an independent party as such. This is a collective. And so that has to be played out. Another thing I think point we ought to make, too, is people seem surprised that Democrats have lost so badly. I think the thing they overlook here is that the Democrats went out and recruited some conservative members to run in a district that had been held by conservative Republicans. And
mm-hmm.
they won a lot of them, more than 80 districts there, I think, the last election. And so it's not surprising now, especially with this move, anti-incumbent move, that the real conservatives will come back and reclaim those districts. So it was kind of you know, the people living in a halo there when Obama mm-hmm. got elected and not realizing mm-hmm. these are very – that's why you saw dismissal of so many freshmen and sophomore congresspersons, that mm-hmm. these issues had been held by Republicans. And so they've mm-hmm. gone back to reclaiming.
Mm-hmm. We have a Tea Party person in our chat room right now, and I'm asking a question about can you define the Tea Party group you belong to, knowing that they're different groups based on the region of the country that you belong to, and mm-hmm. You know, obviously we see the extremes on national television, but I'd like to get more insight in terms of, you know, the profile and how that anger started, but certainly how that anger is going to be generated into a plan of action. Because right now, I think those who are now going to be in power, they're going to have a short space of time between them taking office and then doing something in office.
Right,
and
right.
Also keeping in mind, too, George, is that they've got to learn how to negotiate and deal with those who are in office, the opposite side. So even though the Republicans are now in control of the House of Representatives, that does not mean that they're not totally in control of the House of Representatives. They still have Democrats to deal with and independents, too.
Well, yeah, but they have the numbers. And what they won't be able to do is what John Boehner is trying to do already is going to go back and relitigate all these old issues. That's actually going to happen because, you don't control the Senate, so everybody's not going to control that. And even if you were to get it, you still got to get it to Obama's desk, which he would veto. So I think it we'll see very early what direction they're going to go into. It seems like they still want to go back to some of these old issues that have been settled and see if we can win this time. And I don't think that's going to happen. It'll be a waste of time, but it'll be politics, be pure politics.
Interesting. So what does all this mean for President Obama?
It means November 3rd, the next day after the election, became his first day for campaigning for 2012. That one is they have to get the apparatus ready. Like I said, well, you got that many open seats running for the Senate. Mm-hmm. Republicans had started this plan. I read in the New York Times. They had started this plan 2 years ago where they figure out what they're still going to win and all that.
Absolutely.
Very methodical. I don't see that. Maybe it's not for me to see. But I don't see that on the Democratic side. They got to be shrewd now, go back and do the homework, go back and go all these districts to have a very detailed plan, and especially in terms of defending 23 seats in the Senate. Because otherwise, they'll have both of them. So, I think there's a lot going to happen between what the Republicans do between. Are they going to govern? Mm-hmm. Are they going to be positive in terms of working constructively? Or are they going to stay in a campaign mode? And that's going to have a lot to do with 2012.
That's the question. I want to bring on the air. This is Tea Party Vet. He was in our chat room, and I'm bringing him on. He has a question to ask George Curry. Hello. Sure. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine.
Great. I'm calling you from South Carolina.
Ah, great.
What part of
South
Carolina?
I'm in Darlington, South Carolina. That's
near 95, isn't it? Interstate
95? Very, very near 95.
Okay, that's on that way. Okay, shoot.
Well, I wanted to find out, are you a member of the Tea Party?
Actually, yes, I am. I am the Tea Party Veterans, I'm the head of that organization. We've got about 3,000 members nationwide. I'm one of those folks that the left says it does not exist. I'm African American, or I don't use hyphenated terms. I'm black. So that kind of wipes out the whole racial thing. Matter of fact, I think I'm the only black that's ahead of a national Tea Party organization anyway.
So share with us, give us a sense, because I'm fascinated, first that you're African-American and that two, you have decided to not only belong to this movement but also be a leader in this movement. What led you to not only affiliate yourself as a Tea Party member but also to lead the group?
Well, number one, for me, I'm a conservative. I've been ever since I can remember. But when the whole thing came about with the health care bill, and I started hearing about what they wanted to do and how they wanted to do it, you know, I'm not you know, I have any objections to the health care bill.
Mm-hmm.
I just have objections to what's inside the health care bill. And Nancy Pelosi made the comment that, you'll understand what's in it once you pass it. That became very, very real to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And after seeing that, and then I saw what happened with the stimulus bill, and it just led me, I mean, I got upset about it because it's growing government. It's causing government to get larger and larger at the expense of those folks that are working the hardest. Now, I said years ago, nothing would occur in America to change the political scene more than when the middle class America got upset about a particular issue, no matter what the issue was. But once the middle class got upset about it and got mobilized, it would change the whole political landscape in America. And that's exactly what's happened with the Tea Party. For me, constitutional government, smaller government, and you know, the free market system. I mean,
well, George, do you have a reaction for?
No, I have a couple questions. Were
sure.
you involved when George Bush was running up off the deficit? Were you politically active then?
Oh yeah, I've been politically active for several
years.
Were you
out there protesting? And I'm glad I had this conversation with you too. Were you out there protesting his deficit run when he was in office?
George Bush's deficit?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a bit upset when George did some of the things that he did.
But were you doing anything publicly like you're doing now? And I think you talked earlier about how you moved to activism by what you saw. And I was just simply asking, was that the same case? Were you doing anything publicly like you're doing now when Bush was in office?
Yeah, I did several radio shows and discussed it. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, there you go. But not part of a movement like the Tea Party movement, though,
right? Well, like I said, the thing is, me being an activist is one thing. Now, I've been an activist for a long time for different things. But as I said earlier, you were not going to see a massive movement on the political scene until the middle class got upset. Now the business.
No, I understand that. But I was asking you specifically. You said you did a couple of radio shows, and I'm trying to see whether your frustration came to the point where you became more active as a result of that, and were you active before, and where the change came. That's all.
No, the thing for me is, I was active all the time. Everybody else caught up to me.
Tea Party, I have a question. I actually put it in the chat room too. And George brings up an interesting point. When George Bush the 43rd president took office, we had a surplus. When he left office, we had a deficit. So the question that baffles me is, did the ire and the anger start under the Obama administration, or should it have started under the Bush administration when the deficits actually began and the two wars started?
The anger was escalating when TARP came along.
Well, Bush started that, though.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, the Bush initiative.
TARP caused it. But now let me explain this one to you. Under Clinton, under Bush, matter of fact, going back under Bush number one, the biggest issue that I have with the American people and the American media is this. They show the leader of the American people is the one that takes the blame for everything. There are 535 individuals that sit in either the Senate or in the House that are responsible. They're responsible for writing the bills and passing the laws. There's only one thing that the president does, and that's sign a bill into action or sign it into law. A president gets blamed for it. Obama, President Obama, and I said the same thing for President Bush and Clinton and Bush 1, they get blamed for things that are not necessarily their fault. The health care bill may have been his idea, but what's inside the health care bill, I don't really think he knew everything that was in it. So it is unfair to blame him for everything that's occurring on the political scene.
Yeah, I agree with you on that part. But let me ask you something, because I was unclear about where you're on this health care. Let's be some specifics here. I had a bypass when I was 50 years old, 13 years ago, and it was hard for me, very, very hard for me to get insurance. Under the new health care plan, nobody can deny me insurance for a pre-existing condition. Do you agree with that provision of the health care?
Well,
you shouldn't disqualify people because of pre-existing condition?
You cannot disqualify anyone for a pre-existing condition.
Do you agree with that?
Well, yes and no.
No, yes or no. You can't be both.
No,
let's be straight now. Let's be straight. Do you agree or not?
What you've got is a situation where, in a sense, you're rewarding a situation where a person is doing some things that are stupid.
Wait, hold on. We're talking about Georgia's surgery.
I'm going to give you some background.
Hold on, T-Pain.
We're going to listen to each other. Listen. I don't drink. I don't smoke.
Well,
I grew up in Alabama, so I ate a lot of olive pork growing up, okay? I don't drink. I don't smoke. Don't do drugs,
right. Okay?
Don't do any of that stuff. And but I had a triple bypass when I was 50 years old. Should I be denied insurance?
No, you should not be denied. That's not a provision in the health care bill.
It would be a pre-existing condition. That's the whole purpose of having this kind of health reform.
Well, if you're saying you want that to be in the bill, you asked me about
it. It is in the bill. No, it was passed into law now.
What I'm saying is this. The thing that upsets me more than anything else is the fact that the government says to buy it. Regardless. And then on top of that, they put in there a provision that says if I don't buy it, they're going to fine me incrementally.
Okay, but let's back up. It's a huge bill, 1,000 pages. But I had a specific provision in there that I question you about. I want to know whether you support that or not.
Do I support making a company...
not discriminate against a person who has pre-existing condition?
I don't agree with that.
You don't think you should be able to do that?
Because what you've got is a situation where you're making someone do something that could definitely hurt their business. Say, for instance, you've got someone that's had 15 DUIs. Okay? Now, we're talking insurance for insurance. Someone's had 15 DUIs. Under that, you're setting a precedent saying that an insurance company cannot deny that person.
But nobody's saying it. No. But it doesn't do all that.
Hold on. This is an interesting conversation. I'm going to continue it because we're going to go off the air in just a few minutes. And again, the critical nature of the health care bill rests with what George has just said. George, who was a healthy individual, didn't do anything to overtax his body, has a condition where he has to have a very important surgery, and he's faced with a dilemma in terms of trying to be insured so that he can, A, take care of his medical expenses, and, B, not go broke. And in some cases across the country, people are going broke, not just for their own fault. They're not doing things to their bodies. They just have to get their bodies repaired. And the health care reform bill is in place so that people won't have to stress out like this. They will actually have the medical coverage to take care of themselves. I'm not hearing an explanation from you two-party
then. You can remedy that, though, by forming high-risk pools. And putting into effect a mechanism for those individuals to get catastrophic health insurance. You do not have to mandate it into a bill. What you've done now is you're saying that this is going to bring down the health care insurance so as to more manageable so people can afford it. But if you've got a situation where you're mandating that the health insurance companies themselves have to take these people and put them out in the general pool with everyone else and make them responsible for that financially, you're putting an unfair burden on the health care insurance company.
I'm going to have George respond, but let me just say that my daughter and son-in-law have a unique situation where my son-in-law works for a small business where they actually have a health savings account. And that health savings account was inadequate to deal with some of the health issues that he and my daughter and my young granddaughter had to face. So then when my daughter took a new job, they had to shift everything over to her plan because it gave better coverage. So some of these health plans are not necessarily as comprehensive as a traditional health plan. So it's not quite as cut and dry as that. But George Curry, share with us in closing your situation.
Look, first of all, you know, we spent $2.5 trillion every year on the health care system. And although we spend twice as much as other industrialized countries, roughly about $7,000 a year, $7,100 a year, our health ranks 37th in the world. That's according to the World Health Organization. So we have a tremendous problem of inefficiency here and not helping people who need help. And it has direct consequences on the finances of this country in terms of deficit. This is something that American people need, and I find it abhorrent that somebody can say, we just leave it to the insurance company. We know what we got with the insurance companies. Well, they, you know,
listen,
pharmaceuticals is the most profitable, let me finish, the most profitable country, business sector in this country. And what do we get for it? We see overseas that they can get drugs cheaper and all, and we just let them go rampant? No, it's long, long, long overdue.
But what you've got is a situation where you've got individuals that will take advantage of a system that is provided there freely, okay? And when I say that,
I don't
what I mean
that.
Is,
I don't
I
understand
mean,
it either, right. I have no idea what you're talking about.
You've got individuals that say, okay, give health care to everyone, okay? Give it to them free.
No, nobody said
someone's
that.
Got to pay. No.
Nobody said that.
Yes.
Nobody said give you free. I just gave you an example. I'm not asking for anything free. I just gave you an example that you refused to address.
And
my son-in-law is also paying into the health care plan, too. So we're not talking about free health care.
The whole premise that you're setting this up on is this. Allow someone to get health care where they couldn't get it before, right? Where they cannot be turned down, and they've got to get it, all right? If you got an individual out there that doesn't have health insurance, how are they going to get it then?
Who's going to pay for it? George is going to answer it, and thank you very, very much for your contribution. I want you to call back again so we can have the spirited conversation. George, why don't you answer a question?
Yeah. Look, we're the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't have a national health insurance plan.
Right.
I mean, we are not that unique. All the industrialized countries in the world have this. They see it as an obligation to take care of their citizens. Nobody's asking you to do it for free at all, but we're asking it to be fair, and that we should insist on that, and I don't see how anybody can say to somebody, worse than me, because I'm okay, but worse than me who don't have excess insurance, want to pay for it in a reasonable price, and then we just turn our back and say no while our deficit is going up because it's directly related to that. I just find it abhorrent.
You were only going to be on for like 10 minutes, and you see how important this is.
But that
lets you know just how, these are very complicated matters, and we don't know what's going to happen in the future. But why don't you give us some closing remarks in the last couple of seconds that we have, George Curry, and I really appreciate you staying on the line longer than we had projected.
That's okay. I agree with Tea Party in the sense that, you know, we have responsibility as citizens to be involved. And I think more than ever we need to let the people in Congress let them know that we want some sensible cooperation, that the agenda should not be politics, but what's best for Americans. And that's what we should insist on and make sure that nobody, Democrat or Republican, misinterpret the results of the last election.
Well, I think what you're saying, what we're all going to have to be aware of, is we're going to have to keep everybody accountable. I've heard a lot of screaming and yelling and want to take my country back and a lot of rhetoric And the question is, how can these newly elected representatives, whether they're on the state, local, or federal level, do their job, be accountable, and move the country forward? That is the remaining question. And I know, George Curry, that I'm going to bring you back again and again to discuss these issues, because clearly the next 2 years are going to be quite stressful, anxious, exhilarating at the same time. It's going to be a real roller coaster as we go forward. George Curry, thank you so much for being a guest on my program. And for everyone, go out and make it a great weekend, and we'll be back next week with another interactive, really high-powered show. Thank you so much for being a guest and for listening to Focus on Empowerment. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas. We'll see you next week.